everybody to start. So, on this extra credit problem, what was the general consensus about the voltage out the voltage?
It can be greater than one.
It can be greater than one. Do we all agree with that?
It can.
So, for some values of R, L, and C, V out can be greater than V in, right? How many people do not agree with that? Okay, so my next question then is, if the voltage can be greater than the input, what happens if I put a resistor here?
Stop being bigger than the input.
The voltage is greater than the, if the output voltage is greater than the input, could I dissipate more power at the output than the input?
No.
So the next question is, if this is the, if you think of the input power, you've got currents, you've got voltage, and you think of the output power here. And P out is greater than P in. Now I'm thinking everyone would say no, of course not.
And your efficiency would be greater than 100%.
Yeah.
Right. But I would like to see, as a extension to that problem, I would like to see a proof of this.
Okay. He just gave us another problem. He wants us to prove conservation of energy. So we don't get any ideas.
Now, of course, this particular configuration is actually pretty easy because we've got to choose it. But nevertheless, it would be nice to see a proof. Because if the voltage is going up, why can't the current go up?
So we're checking the voltage to an infinite resistance.
Well, the current does go up. It's just at a different point in time.
Now, don't start confusing us. So, the question is, if the voltage goes up, the current must go down, right? Because the power cannot be greater. The power out cannot be greater than the power in. But if you can work through the circuit's equation to show this. And I'll return the problems this weekend, and Tao is going to spend some time next week in the recitation showing you how to model and manipulate that circuit in MATLAB. And then hopefully that will bring some kind of nice closure to all this.
Closure?
No, we're not talking about feedback.
Why not?
Because I just did that circuit.
Did you really?
Yeah, I even told myself I wasn't coming to class today because I'd already done it once.
So you're taking DE and thermo and science.
Okay, so I can take it easy today. You can tell me everything about this lecture.
Yeah, let's do that.
That's the same thing.
It is the same thing.
Yeah, we actually had that.
This is in which circuits?
Advanced.
2 hours ago.
That's
the same circuit.
Well, it's a feedback circuit, but surely. Well, first of all, did you do it in PowerPoint?
No, he did it up. But well, he did it on a whiteboard, so the background is
something like about. He and I are very close friends, and we argued. We don't see the world the same way, so.
So the other side of the coin will be presented.
Well, I don't know about that, but so what did you talk about today in certain about feedback?
Stability and
really?
Poles and
it makes increased bandwidth, decreases the gain. Poles and zero.
Talk about the complex plane.
We even
kind of what he did is he got a signals book and he read the last chapter and he was like, I'm taking the wind out of this wind sail.
I
It actually was it actually talked a good bit about the S domain, except not really.
It's just interesting that we've been going through some restructuring of the curriculum, and it was my understanding that they took all the Laplace stuff out of circuits courses and left it for here.
They may have taken it out of the intro courses. It was still there when I took it. Like, we still saw Laplace in 4A and had no idea what we were doing.
It's not like he actually sat down and did Laplace transforms. He just kind of like talked about, hey, in the S domain, stuff works like this. So,
and for the record, that our actual instructor was out of town that week when we took it, so we had a substitute.
Oh, you're talking about?
Not today.
No. In intro.
I was talking about today.
Yeah, right. I was talking about intro.
Well, anyway, we'll go through it anyway because I got the slides and I got to do something.
Well, I mean, we showed up.
Dude,
we might as well.
Let's watch YouTube videos.
There probably is a YouTube lecture on feedback. But anyway, so we'll go through it, and you guys can teach me something about all this. So this is a typical feedback system. We have an input that we would like to control. So we have some box that we put past the summer, and essentially you have the input and you have this plant, and you have the output, and you'd like to be able to somehow control the output of the plant. So what we're going to do is to insert two blocks that allow us some degree of control over the system. And that general concept is what we call the area of control systems, or control theory of controls. Now, why do we attempt to use feedback? Why do we want to use feedback? You might say, well, why don't we just design the plant right? Well, in fact, there are a lot of applications where we don't really have control over the plant. All we can do is add external control. There are a lot of applications where the behavior of the plant is unpredictable. For example, if you are in the business of making consumer cleaning products, which involve mixing all sorts of nasty chemicals to the right concentration so that out pops your favorite dishwashing liquid or your favorite floor cleaner. What's one of the challenges that you will face in that business?
Well, actually,
you can get it. A more, even more interesting case is winemaking. Winemaking is actually a very interesting case of feed forward versus feedback type controls. But I'm sensing you don't have a whole lot of experience with winemaking, so we'll stick to dishwashing.
Be surprised.
Yeah,
I'll
need one.
So your goal is to build some product which requires a really sophisticated mix of chemicals. And actually, semiconductors have the same problem, the exact same problem, semiconductor manufacturing. So what are some of the things you're going to do to make sure that that product that comes out the end truly is exactly what you expect it to be in terms of the concentrations of the chemicals and such?
I guess it's in different stages in the production process.
Yeah, generally you're not going to grab 8 vats and just dump them together. You're going to do it one at a time so you can check them at each stage. I mean, you
not
could
necessarily.
Do it the other way.
You'll do whatever is faster and cheaper.
So, would you check your product that you got out and then change your manufacturing process to fix it?
So the very first thing you're going to do is you're going to have to buy these input chemicals, right?
Right.
And if you want the output to be correct, what are you going to do at the input side?
Make sure you have enough chemicals.
Make sure you have enough?
In the proper amount.
The right proportions.
The right recipe.
So let's say it takes, let's take, whatever you're making takes 1% hydrochloric acid, I don't know, whatever they use in these things. And it takes 99% water, let's keep it simple. So you go and you buy your hydrochloric acid, right? You're going to go and contract with a vendor to buy your hydrochloric acid. And the vendor's going to tell you, you're going to have the vendors line up, and some of them are going to be much cheaper than you know, you got your Mr. Hydrochloric Acid company that owns like, you know, 80% of the market, and then you've got all these little ones that are going to try to sell it to you at less, claiming much less cost, right? So how are you going to deal with this?
Choose whichever one gives you the best gifts.
No, that's what works in Japan. But after you get past the gifts and all the free dinners and all that, what are you going to be worried about?
Quality.
Quality. How so?
Because if you're paying 80% of the price for 50% of the purity, you're losing hydrochloric acid and getting nothing out of it.
Purity. So what's purity? Purity is the quality of the chemical, right?
Right.
But all these people claim to be delivering you the same product.
Generally, there's a standard.
So what you would have done 40, 50 years ago is you would sign a contract that's a contract of trust with the vendor that they're going to deliver you 1%, you know, hydrochloric acid with, I don't know, 95% purity, whatever that means. Because that's what you told them you need for your final output to be correct. And that's essentially what we would call a feed-forward approach. You're going to make sure that the things going into the system are strictly controlled so that the things that come out of the system are correct. That was the way manufacturing was done 40, 50 years ago. So what happens in that kind of a scenario is one day you wake up and 30 people in some city in Oregon have died because they decided to drink the liquid for some reason, and the liquid had more hydrochloric acid in it than it should have. What happened?
Heaven's Gate.
Your vendor gave you chemicals that did not
meet spec. Of course, normally it goes
okay,
the other
so
way.
After you learn through that experience, and manufacturing in the U.S. through about the 60s operated essentially in a feed-forward mode, and in the 70s when quality control became very popular, even in the 60s they were interested in this, but they started to deal with this from a feed-forward point of view, trying to make sure that what goes into the factory is as pure and correct as possible with what comes out, so that what comes out is exactly what it should be. But there's a problem with that with most of these chemical mixtures are interesting because, first of all, the quality and the purity of the chemicals change, and it's very hard to control that from what I understand with a lot of these things.
Especially when
so you go back to your vendor, I'm sorry, you go back to your vendor and you say, you know, that stuff, that batch you gave me sucked, fix it. And the vendor will say, well, you know, to fix it to keep the tolerance you want, it's going to cost you 10 times more. Because I just can't control the process of making this chemical to that level of precision. And this is very common with chemicals and other things because they vary as a function of the raw materials that are going in. I don't know if you've been following the gypsum wallboard thing that's going on in Florida, but they built a whole bunch of houses in Florida. There was a wallboard shortage. So they built a whole bunch of houses in Florida out of wallboard that they happened to be able to get when there was a shortage, and that wallboard just happened to come from China. That wallboard was built from gypsum that was mined from some mines that had a sulfur content which was much higher than what is normally expected in the U.S. So several months after people started living in these houses, their flat screen TVs that were hanging on the wall were failing. They took the flat screen TV apart and found that all the wiring inside was corroded. The wiring was corroded because the wallboard is emitting acidic gases that are corroding the wiring.
Sounds like a health issue.
So then, if you haven't read about this, read about it. It's one of these classic engineering stories. So then, of course, they go to the builder. The builder says, well, the wallboard we got meets ASME or whoever it is specs wallboard. They go to the government, the same deal. But finally, after digging through all of this, they've shown that the wallboard is, in fact, emitting corrosive gases than it should. And the houses that were built with this are pretty much going to have to be torn down because all the wiring inside, all the plumbing inside, everything is corroding. It's in the walls.
That happened in Mississippi on the coast where I'm from.
Yeah, basically any time that apparently they try to go get wallboard from outside the country, they
make sure your sheetrock's made in the USA. You know? Yeah.
So it's very hard to control, you know, to make a long story short, it's very hard, even when there's the best of intentions, it's very hard to control what's going in. Winemaking is a good example because the quality of the grapes has a lot to do with the wine, and it's just an art. Every bottle, every batch of wine that comes out is a little different than the previous one. So faced with that, the fact that you cannot adequately control these inputs, and adequately controlling these inputs may cost a lot of money, a better solution is to try to actually monitor things in real time and adjust inputs so that you get the desired output. This gets really complicated with chemical mixtures because apparently the product of these chemical processes is not very easily controllable. So this has been studied a lot with chemical processes because there's a lot of feedback control in chemical processes because based on humidity and temperature and all these kinds of things, it's often very hard to control make the output come out proper unless you actually monitor it in real time and control the inputs. So one of the main reasons we use feedback is to reduce sensitivity to uncertainties and variabilities in the input and such. And another way we do this is we've talked about examples like bridges where you want to make sure they don't vibrate too much, so you put some damping into the bridges. And rate car racing, those automobiles have a lot of active control in them now, especially high performance vehicles. That are all, and all these things are based on feedback. Another example that is often cited in this kind of thing is when you're trying to do positioning. You want to move a telescope or something like that to a particular point. And there's a good way to do this and a wrong way to do this. If you don't do it with the right kind of feedback, you're going to the telescope's essentially going to constantly adjust itself because you would really like the movement to be smooth, but that requires the proper kind of feedback in the system, because if you just try to move it directly to the position, you're going to have to deal with the overshoot and the undershoot, and this thing is going to be very hard to get it to be positioned correctly and to move in a smooth manner.
So you almost want a certain fuzziness.
Well, you want to, remember last class we talked about second order responses. You want the system to be overdamped so that the movement, in this case, so the movement is slow. But that requires essentially putting a filter, if you will, into the feedback you're getting on the position of the telescope so that it moves gracefully.
It's how servos work, isn't it?
Right. And another example of this that's often cited is your thermostats on the wall. You want, when you design a thermostat, if you make it react instantaneously to changes in temperature, you're going to cycle your heating system on and off or your cooling system too much, and you're going to waste a lot of energy. So they actually have a kind of hysteresis built into them, so that you're conserving energy as you try to maintain a constant temperature. And then another contemporary example of this are our missiles. A lot of the missiles today are actually guided by GPS and things like that, and they're doing constantly adjusting their position rather than the way it used to be done 40, 50 years ago, where you would just aim and shoot and hope they shoot the target. And that allows them to have, rather than having to predict the wind speeds and all these kinds of things, they can just basically give it a coordinates, point it in a direction, and it can autonomously adjust until it reaches the target. So closed-loop systems automatically adjust until the proper coordinates are achieved, and they allow you to deal with issues like inertia, momentum, and stability in that. Now, I bet Dr. Koshka didn't talk about that.
Well, telescopes work well.
But actually, in terms of electrical engineering and this kind of thing that we were talking about, semiconductor manufacturing, it's very hard to get the purity of chemicals correct on the input side of semiconductor manufacturing, and the purity of the chemicals plays a really significant role in the quality of the ultimate circuit. So there's a lot of monitoring of the process at all stages to make sure that things are being adjusted for optimal performance. Otherwise, these circuits that you get out would have all sorts of crazy flaws. I've seen solder, you know, you see these x-rays of solder joints that are made with different purities of chemicals, and there's significant differences in the quality of the solder joints based on the purity of the chemicals. And I've seen yields from production lines go from 25% yield, 25%, to 90% just by introducing more pure chemicals and by introducing more feedback into the loop. So it's when you're in the manufacturing business, you deal with this. If you ever, you know, I love watching I think Food Channel has one on manufacturing of food, and Science Channel has one on manufacturing of products. But all these shows that talk about how products are manufactured, it's really amazing stuff, how they can actually make sure that at the end of that line, you get that little product that looks exactly like, you know, what you think. And if you think about all the complexity involved, all the different systems that contribute to that final thing, and most of those systems have a lot of feedback in them to account for the subtle variations in the machinery and the chemicals and things like that. So the transfer function of this system, we've already introduced this. If we take a system like this, we can essentially write the transfer function by writing the error E of S is equal to X of S minus R of S. And X of S comes from the input. R of S can be written as G of S times Y of S. And then, so that we can get that E of S is equal to X of S minus G of S times Y of S. Y of S also can be written as E of S times H of S. So that gives us two equations. We can combine this result and this result, and we can then solve for Y of S over X of S, and we can write that the overall transfer function is H of S over 1 plus G of S times H of S. And we can actually, the process of computing transfer functions for these networks has been studied extensively in the circuits literature, and there's a number of ways that you can get at those relationships. The closed-loop transfer function can also be given by, you can find it by computing the forward gain and dividing it by 1 minus the loop gain. And the forward gain is the total gain of the forward path from input to output. And the loop gain is the total gain along the closed path shared by all systems. So that's just another way of saying you've got the forward gain over the loop gain. And of course, we can extend that kind of analysis to more complicated systems. So here I show a system with three components and a summer, and you can actually write the transfer function of that system using applying that that formula. We won't dwell on that this semester, but you'll see that kind of thing if you go on into the controls course. Now, the thing we want to talk about today is the use of feedback to control or compensate for the system. So, assume the open loop gain is very large, like we have an op-amp. And in fact, op-amps that you've dealt with in your electronics class are an example of a circuit that is requires feedback to be useful. So, if this box has a gain K, we can write this in terms of, instead of S, we'll use J omega. But we can write this, that if K is very large, then the overall system is going to be K times P divided by 1 plus K times P times G. And if K is very, very large, we can ignore the 1, and we can write that the overall gain of the system is 1 over G of J omega. And you'll notice that in that case now, this system is independent of this. The overall transfer function is independent of this. Our plant. And that's a good thing, because that allows us to control the system. So here we have an example of that with an op-amp. We have an op-amp and we have a feedback path, which can be as simple as a ratio of two resistors. And we can, since the gain of the op-amp is very, very large, the overall transfer function for this system just becomes proportional to the ratio of those resistors. And the nice thing about this is the closed loop gain depends only on the passive components, R1 and R2, and it's independent of the open loop gain of the op-amp. Now, why is that result nice from a manufacturing process point of view? So you're now running your company op amps or us, and these things are popping out of your manufacturing line at, you know, thousands a second. Why is this kind of a circuit very useful when you're dealing with these infinite gain op amps?
Op amp tolerances can vary.
Op amp tolerances can vary. And in this case, you can use, you don't really care what the gain of the op, what the specific gain of the op amp is. It might be 1,000, it might be 1,000,000, it might be 10,000. As long as it's sufficiently large that this approximation is reasonable, you can provide circuits, amplifiers, if you will, where you're in control of the gain and you're relatively independent of the particular proper gain, the actual gain of the op amp. And that's, as I said, you've all used feedback to stabilize op amp circuits. Now, the other piece of this is the issue of stability. If this plant has a tendency to become unstable, can we stabilize the system by inserting controllers? And that's a principle that's used in many different applications to allow systems that could potentially go unstable and be catastrophic, like nuclear reactors or power plants and such, to keep them operating comfortably. So the question is, can we design these two boxes, we'll call this the compensator and this the gain, can we design these two systems so that the overall system is stable? So here we have the transfer function of the overall system, C of S times P of S, divided by 1 plus the closed loop gain, which is 1 plus C of S, G of S times P of S. So the question becomes, what if we know the properties of P of S, what must we use for C of S and G of S so that we can achieve some level of control over P of S? So the first thing that we'll look at is what's called proportional feedback. We're going to use just a direct feedback connection here, and we'll have a simple system here, which is just a gain. So the overall system, then, the overall transfer function of this system is going to be K times S, K over S minus 2, divided by 1 plus K, G of S is 1, and P of S is S minus 2, so we have 1 plus K over S minus 2. And therefore, if you simplify this by multiplying by S minus 2 over S minus 2, the overall transfer function is K over S minus 2 plus K. Now, what's the what are the implications of that for stability?
S can't be 2.
So S minus 2, is this system stable?
No. It has a pole right of the matching reactor.
Right. The pole of this system is at S equals 2. The impulse response of this system is e to the 2 times t, which is unstable. So how can we make this system, can we make this system stable by adjusting k?
If you made k negative, would it?
So what do we need to do to the denominator to make the system stable? We need to move the pole from the right half plane to the left half plane.
So k has to be larger than 2.
So if k is greater than 2, we can put that pole in the left half plane. So that's a very simple example of how, and I bet Koshka didn't use the job to develop on the whiteboard.
You would be surprised.
I mean, it's got cat-like reflex.
He did have some kind of analogy with a religious organ.
We argue a lot about whether we should use PowerPoint in class.
I'm glad that people support the whiteboard.
Well, if you saw my handwriting, you wouldn't be so glad. So the transfer function is stable for k greater than 2, but the key thing here is that we can adjust k until the system is stable. So with this kind of an arrangement, you can sit in the lab and adjust this until the system is stable. And that process is what's important. It essentially gives you the ability to control the system, which is why we would call this a control system. Yeah?
Hey, but k and 1 over f minus 2 aren't in the feedback loop, right?
Right. So this is a simple example. This is what's called a proportional feedback controller.
Okay, so...
And there's actually another problem with this. What's one of the problems with this adjusting k in this manner? This is a great control system because there's actually something pretty bad about this. If you're, you know, if you're producing, dishwashing liquid out here or whatever your favorite thing is, as you adjust k, are you going to get the same product out here?
No.
Why?
Because the product more bags changing too.
Because as you the overall gain of this transfer function changes as a function of k, right? So even though you're using k to adjust for stability, you're sort of still not able to. It'd be nice if you could do this adjustment in a way that you preserve the overall system gain. Right? You'd like the gain, for example, to be 1 independent of the value of k, but you'd also like the system to be stable. So this isn't the best control system. This is just one of the simplest examples of a control system. In most real systems, this would be a problem because the overall level of the output is changing. So it'd be like the analogy might be something like the volume. Even though the radio would be working fine, the volume of the output signal would be constantly changing if you were having to do this adjustment in real time.
Okay.
So that'd be kind of annoying. And that's why with a lot of radios use a lot of feedback. They have phase lock loops and things like this, but obviously they keep the output signal at a constant volume level, even though there's all sorts of stuff going on inside the radio, trying to track the signal and demodulate it and adjust its amplitude and all those kinds of things. I think the students' work will work on the CECON robots. Obviously, have to use a lot of feedback in those systems. So you'll be faced with these kinds of things, and you'll ultimately build circuits that have programmable feedback in them. Now, a more interesting or more complex example is a second-order system, where we have here we have a second-order plant, 1 over s squared minus 4. And now we're going to try to use proportional feedback on this system. So the overall transfer function is going to be k over s squared minus 4 divided by 1 plus k over s squared minus 4, the open loop gain divided by the closed loop gain. And if you then simplify that, you get k over s squared minus 4 plus k. So how do we find the poles of this system? Well, we can use a quadratic equation, and one of the poles is going to be at the square root of 4 minus k, because we essentially have s squared minus or plus a constant here, so you're going to have two roots, and one of those roots is at the square root of 4 minus k. This is greater than 0 if k is less than 4, and if k is greater than 4, then this is complex. So this particular system is unstable for all values of k. We can't make that system conditionally stable using just that simple gain circuit. So we can try a more sophisticated control unit, K1 plus K2 times X. And this is, and since we have K2 times S here in a time domain, what is that equivalent to? Multiplication by S is equivalent to what in the time domain?
Derivative.
So this is called proportional feedback because this block is essentially, the output is proportional to the derivative of the input. Now we're showing in the Laplace domain, but in the time domain, that's essentially what this is. It's a differentiator. So in this case, the overall gain of the system is going to be K1 plus K2S over S squared minus 4. That's the open loop gain, divided by 1 plus the closed loop gain, which is K1 plus K2S over S squared minus 4. So again, if we multiply top and bottom by S squared minus 4, we can simplify this to K1 plus K2S over S squared plus K2S plus K1 minus 4. And this system, again, you can use the quadratic equation to find the roots, and you can show that this system is stable as long as K2 is greater than 0 and K1 is greater than 4. So now we've got two controls, K1 and K2, that allow us to keep the system stable. And we can actually play with these two a little bit to control the impulse response, basically whether it's overdamped, underdamped, that kind of thing.
So why can we make the first one conditionally, or the second one conditionally stable, but the first one we cannot make conditionally stable?
Because the pole, this has a pole at square root of 4 minus k. And when k goes when k is less than 4, this is positive, so the pole is in the right half plane.
Right.
When k is greater than 4, this thing goes negative, which means we get a pole at
imaginary.
J, the imaginary plane. Is that stable or unstable? Well, we call that marginally stable. What does that mean from a response point of view when the system is marginally stable?
Can't really predict what it's going to do.
It's underdamped.
Yeah, we talked about that. It's like how poor it is from.
If you have a system which is marginally stable, and you hit it, do my pound again. That system stable or unstable?
That one's stable.
Why?
Because it's not still doing that.
When you listen, if you listen, you hear it dying out, right?
Yeah.
The what actually controls how much you hear of that?
Mm-hmm.
And what well, control? Well, so what are some of the things? This is actually an interesting case. If you listen carefully, what are some of the things that control the stability of that? Your first instinct is to say the mechanical properties of the wall and the whiteboard, right?
Mm-hmm.
But listen again.
The acoustics of the room.
You can hear the reverberation. Now, what happens when you get in really reverberant rooms?
It
goes on for quite a while. In fact, I don't know if you've ever been to CAVS. If you go into CAVS, they have a conference room that has a circular roof, kind of cut out circular roof kind of thing. And it's a really interesting reverberant chamber because if you stand in the middle of that circle, you can actually hear the reverberations. And if you step just to the side of that, there's a big drop off. You get this nice resonance sitting in the middle of that circular room.
It's like that at the entrance of Swalm, too. They have that going on.
Perhaps the hallways here is another good example. The hallways in this building are so, stairways are so reverberant that you can't even carry on a conversation in those.
It's awesomely terrible.
So of course we have audio technology now that will allow you to sit in this room, to set up surround sound speakers, and to sit in the middle of this room and actually sound like a really high quality concert theater or concert hall. Even though this room, if you listen, has a lot of reverberation to it, and not the good kind of reverberation. So how do you go about building a system that can take that into account? Well, you build feedback and you take measurements and you try to understand the room acoustics from a transfer function point of view. You invert that transfer function to take out the room acoustics, and then you add to that transfer function the acoustics of the concert hall. And guess what? This is all done inside your stereo with a digital filter that's been designed to affect the combination of the desired room acoustics divided by the actual room acoustics. So, so getting back to this example, if this room were unstable, what would happen when I did this?
Eventually, the ceiling would fall in on us.
Right. And then, so if the room is marginally stable, what happens?
It's going to go on forever.
It goes on forever. So, marginal stability is bad because once energy hits the system, it will oscillate forever. Now, in the real world, can we have marginal stability? No, we can have things that are pretty close to it. In the hallways, the stairways are a pretty good approximation to that. You get really long, large reverberations in the stairways. So, so the deal is that the best type of feedback controller is going to depend on the properties of the system, and that's why mechanical systems you'll see a lot of different kinds of controllers. But the beauty of doing everything digitally is then we just have to synthesize the feedback with a digital filter of a prescribed shape. We don't have to actually build different kinds of mechanical systems. Again, auto racing cars, for example, race cars have a lot of different kinds of feedback controllers on them. They've got active suspension, they've got aerodynamics, they've got steering, all these kinds of things. All sorts of things associated with the engine, monitoring fuel, and all that kind of thing. So those, what makes an automobile very complicated is all the different kinds of mechanical feedback systems they have. They're trying to make more and more of those electronic, but at some point you need to control the mechanical process. So even if you do all the computations electronically, you still need the actuators that allow you to adjust the mechanical systems and things like that. So with this additional proportional controller, we've actually been able to damp and, to stabilize the system. And that's not the only option, but we would like to use, generally with feedback systems, you want to use as simple a controller as possible, as few number of degrees of freedom as possible. So, what we've done today, we've introduced the concept of system control. We've shown you a way of computing the overall gain of the system. The process of computing the transfer function of a network has actually been a problem that's been studied in graph theory. And if you ever look at, you don't see much of this anymore in our curricula, but for many years, the advanced circuit analysis was actually done by taking the circuit and transforming it into a matrix representation and doing all the computations with matrices. So you can actually derive the transfer function of a system using a matrix, using a linear algebra process. Similarly, when you talk about computing the gain of this network and some of the properties of the network, the actual theory draws on a lot of results from topology and graph theory. So if you look at an advanced textbook in these areas, you'll see a lot of concepts relating to graphs and such. And one of the areas that really emerged early on was the idea that you could take a circuit, describe it as a matrix, and operate on that matrix to minimize the number of components in the circuit, but still preserve the end-to-end transfer function capability of the circuit. And that's a problem that's been solved by using some nice results from linear algebra. And Black's formula is essentially a case of that. The proof of Black's formula comes about through those kinds of
representations of the circuit. So ultimately, circuit analysis is actually a linear algebra problem, but you don't really see it that way in your curriculum these days. But in terms of what's sort of going on inside the computer, the circuits are essentially being treated as matrices and all the calculations are done in linear algebra. We've demonstrated how we can stabilize first-order systems using proportional feedback and second-order systems using damping. And that's another example of why, at some point, once you know the order of the system you're trying to deal with, you know a lot about the properties of that system, and you can then derive the appropriate kind of control for the system. So one of the key things in this analysis is to be able to come up with some kind of model of your system. You need to know what the nature of P of S before you can actually control the system. Now, with complicated systems, especially nonlinear systems, it's sometimes difficult to come up with a P of S model, and that's why sometimes you'll see systems that have feedback that still fail, because they're designed to control the system over a certain range of operation, but they can't handle the extreme cases. And that's one of the engineering trade-offs that you'll face. Another reason I didn't talk about at the beginning of class, about another interesting use for feedback that sort of relates to that, is sometimes the characteristics of your plant will change. You may have a failure in your plant, and you want the system to be able to adapt to that failure. I don't know if you remember, several years ago, we had some workers killed. They were working on one of the antenna towers down in Jackson, and they were doing maintenance on it, replacing the bars, how these structures are built in the frame, and they've got these members. And they decided to replace a diagonal member in that structure, and as they took the member out, the structure collapsed and they were killed. And it turned out that the reason that happened was because by taking that member out, they stressed the structure beyond what its limits were, and there was some kind of rusted or failed bolt or something that caused the structure to collapse. But had the structure been in perfect condition, that might not have happened. But they were sort of doing maintenance because the structure was kind of rusting, and they needed to fix something. So they go up these structures and they basically look at all the welds and all the bolts and all that. But in that particular case, when they removed that member, that structure was not redundant. Some of these structures are designed so that you can lose one or two of the members and they still maintain their structural rigidity, but that, of course, costs you extra money because it's more metal. This particular structure was kind of on the edge, and then when they removed that member, it collapsed. So when you're dealing with things like nuclear power plants, you have to design your control structures so that if the plant changes characteristic dramatically, like something fails in it, you still have to be able to control the structure. Again, another good example of this are race cars. Race cars are designed they're very heavily optimized for a particular operating condition. Now, why do you think race cars so easily flip? Well, once they get out of that they're going at such high speed, and once they get out of that point, which they've been optimized, they become terribly unstable. So that's why when they get in these accidents, if you've ever seen a race car, when it just, sort of turns unexpectedly slightly, then all of a sudden they'll just start flipping, because they've been so heavily optimized for a particular aerodynamic condition that when they get off that point, then now all those baffles and all those things they have are going to cause pressure with the airflow and basically make the car flip. So they're very unstable systems in that they work really well when everything is fine, but if there's anything like a tire or suspension or steering or something, they'll very often go into a catastrophic failure. So a lot of what you try to do with feedback, in addition to controlling the system, is make sure that when something catastrophic happens, you can still maintain some level of control of the system. And that's why knowing the system and being able to account for the changes of the system are very important. Now, why can't we simply cancel the poles? Well, in real systems, we never know the exact location of the poles. tolerances of components or tolerances over wear and tear and things like that. So slight errors in predicting these values can be fatal. The very first active noise cancellation headsets, when they hit the market, were pretty rough because they worked really well, but when they didn't work well, they actually made... So what noise canceling headphones do is they inject noise to cancel the ambient noise. Now this, the when they were first developing these, they actually had a lot of catastrophic failures. You would see these demos where they would show everything works fine in a typical airplane noise or whatever. We many years ago when I was with Texas Instruments, we did a demo at a conference where we had a Lotus automobile. You could sit in the driver's seat and play all sorts of noise, and everything worked fine. But if you deviated from that condition slightly, the noise that you were injecting got out of phase with the ambient noise, and you actually increased the overall amount of noise. So the early noise-canceling headphones were terrible because when they would fail, they would blow your ears out. I mean, they would really, the amount of noise would double or triple over what the ambient noise was if they couldn't get the equalization just right. So when you try to do this feed-forward prediction of pole location, it's difficult because if you're off by the slightest amount, you can actually make things significantly worse. And so there, you know, there's many reasons why you need this active control, feedback control system. That's what allows most systems to operate in a safe manner through a wide range of operating conditions, including catastrophic failures and things. And most systems in the real world can be thought about in terms of feedback. Another interesting example of all this is traffic control. When you're in a major metropolitan area, one of the things that makes traffic control so challenging is that when an expressway becomes backed up and they broadcast the traffic report on the radio or you get it on your GPS or whatever, what happens is people start shifting their traffic patterns. So it's a constantly changing environment because everybody's listening to the same news and reacting to it. So you can actually be in situations where the best thing to do is to just stay on the road you're on, because when that road becomes backed up and everybody starts moving off that road, then that road's the one that clears up, and all the feeder roads are the ones that get backed up. So in major metropolitan areas, when they do control of traffic, it's a very subtle thing they have to do, because the last thing in the world you want is people constantly kind of getting on and off expressways trying to take shortcuts and things. There's a lot of dynamic control that goes into those kinds of applications. And if you go on to the senior level options and controls or in the graduate courses, you'll get a chance to study this in a lot more detail. But it's all based, for continuous time systems, it's all based on Laplace transform. For discrete time systems, it's based on Z transforms. Okay, I'll see you on Monday. And remember, you've got another problem, so let's say by
Friday.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Do we have class on Friday?
No, we don't have class on Friday. So
midnight,
Thursday night.
Or
exactly.
What
are
we supposed to talk about?
And then
what's this guy like? I
missed
this part.
Yeah, I did.
Okay, the question is, now that we've shown you can get a higher voltage here, that starts to make you think I could get more power. So can I get a gain in power?
No,
and prove that you can't.
Well, I mean, that's dumb.
No, that's not dumb.
I mean,
because prior to this, you weren't sure about the voltage gain.
Yeah.
But if there's voltage gain, why is there power gain?
The law of conservation.
So prove it.
So, like, just add a resistor in parallel?
No, this is a circuit.
We're checking the voltage.
Okay.
This is one easy, actually, because you essentially have series resistors here. So, now that you've got a model for this, just see what happens when you try to draw power over.
So, how would we.
I've got an idea.
Well, the thing that I want to know is, like, how can we configure this circuit so it still has voltage gain, like, across the capacitor?
But that was the answer to the first problem.
Well, now there's another resistor in it, like, that's in parallel to the impedance of the capacitor. Like,
right. So, some people have certain spike simulations of this. take those simulations now and add the resistor. There's a couple things that are going to happen. One of them is like the voltage here is going to drop because you're going to look at it.
Right, but I mean, you imagine you could tinker with it so that that voltage is still like optimized. But like, I'm not saying
the
power.
What's the maximum gain that you can get?
For voltage? For power. Now, I'm not talking about power, I'm talking about voltage. So
yeah, we're past voltage.
Okay, well, fine.
What's the maximum? What's the ratio of output power to input power? What's the maximum PL and PTA that you
would
get?
I've got the the Dremel.
Oh yeah, I used the hand power sander, but I guess I just didn't work on it enough. Like I thought it would be okay because I kind of have a mirror finish. I don't know, I didn't really have anything to compare it to, so I didn't really ask anyone. I guess I should have like asked to see more examples of like, you know, what's a red ribbon bent and what's a...
I definitely, I'm not going to deny that. If an actual person asked me, I'd probably deny it.